There was a long silence. Finally, Taji said, "I'd go to college." Sean responded, "What would it take for you to do that?" After several moments of reflection, her eyes lit up. "I'd need to get into the right high school." They set a goal for Taji to earn a scholarship to one of the top-tier prep schools in the surrounding area. Sean asked, "Where should we start?" Taji led the process, but together they figured out which schools would be the best fit. They completed applications and prepared for her high school interviews. Then, the night before one of the biggest interviews, Taji's family left her at home to do her homework while they went out for a drive. As the family pulled up to a stop sign, a gunman approached the car, firing multiple bullets into the vehicle that was transporting three small children. Taji's older cousin was shot in the back, and her six-year-old sister was shot in the leg. Nobody died, but it was traumatic in every conceivable way. The next morning, Sean suggested Taji might want to reschedule the high school interview they had planned. But through her emotions, she yelled, "This is how I am going to get out of here. This is what I need to do to have the kind of life I want. And this is how I can help my family and make sure it doesn't happen again." She wiped her tears, went to the interview, and blew away everyone she met. Tajiana was accepted to four competitive preparatory schools, earning full scholarships to each. She now attends Sacred Heart, a private school in Atherton, California, and has flourished into a resilient, motivated, and strikingly bright 14-year-old girl. Out of the 17 students in Sean's 8th grade program, 12 have received scholarships to prestigious prep schools, and the other 5 have entered rigorous college track programs. Sean served as a challenger, helping these youth raise their aspiration level and build the mental agility they would need to get and stay on a course of success. Whether it is Matt McCauley at Gymboree extending the $2 challenge, or Shai Agassi inviting his team to find a way to change a battery in less than 5 minutes, or Sean Mendy issuing the college-bound challenge, our research showed that multipliers use their intelligence to make challenges concrete for others. These challenges become tangible and measurable, allowing people to assess their performance. And by making a challenge real, they allow others to visualize the achievement and communicate the confidence that the organization has the collective brain power required. This confidence is essential because the challenge will demand the entire organization to extend beyond its current reach and capability. Ask the hard questions. Diminishers give answers. Good leaders ask questions. Multipliers ask the really hard questions. They ask the questions that challenge people not only to think, but to rethink. They ask questions so immense that people can't answer them based on their current knowledge or where they currently stand. To answer these questions, the organization must learn. Enabled by these big questions, a vacuum is created. It is a vacuum between what people know and what they need to know to answer the question. It also is a vacuum between what they can currently do and what they need to be able to do. This vacuum creates a deep tension in the organization and raises a need to reduce that tension. It is like a rubber band that is stretched to its limit. One side needs to move toward the other to reduce the tension. Matt McCauley at Gymboree created this forward pull when he asked each member of his organization, "What is your Mission Impossible?" Shai Agassi created this tension at Better Place when he asked, "How would we build an infrastructure to switch batteries from any electric car anywhere in the world and do it cheaply?" Let others fill in the blanks. How do multipliers get people to step into a challenge? They shift the burden of the thinking to others. Initially, when they establish a concrete challenge, the burden of the thinking sits with them as the leader. But by asking the hard questions and inviting others to fill in the blanks, they are shifting the burden of thinking onto their people. The intellectual onus now sits with their team to understand the challenge and find a solution. It is in this shift that the multiplier creates intelligence and energy around him or herself. After assuming leadership of a new division in a large consumer electronics company in Korea, the CEO called his management team together and informed them of his goals to be number one in the market and to become a magnet company attracting top college graduates. He was clear that the trajectory for the organization would not be incremental. He had a vision of something big. He then engaged a broad array of stakeholders in analyzing how to achieve the number one position. The coalition included key executives, founding family members, and outside consultants. Assembling the coalition, he seeded the opportunity and posed the difficult questions such as, why are we in this business? And do we deserve to be in this business? And what would it take to be better than our competition? These questions cut to the bones of the organization and stirred up chaos, yet he never backed down. The tension forced the team to generate answers. He asked the hard questions and then let the team fill in the blanks. As they did, he maintained a tight time frame. He said, I don't need 100% answers. I need a 30% answer in 2 days. Give me a 30% answer so we can talk about it and decide if it makes sense for you to find a 50% answer. And if we get there, we'll block 2 months to get a 100% answer. In the end, there were clear answers. The process took months and was scrappy, but it built the intellectual muscle and energy the organization needed for the challenge. Laying down a challenge means more than directing people to do it. It includes asking the hard questions that no one yet has the answers to, and then backing off so that the people within the organization have the space to think through the questions, take ownership, and find the answers. When a multiplier has successfully laid down the challenge, people see the stretch, are intrigued, and become intellectually engaged. The burden of thinking has been shifted to the organization. This process of ownership and stretch continues to build energy by creating the intellectual muscle for the challenge. 3. Generate belief. By seeding the opportunity and laying down a challenge, people are interested in what is possible. But this isn't enough to create movement. Multipliers generate belief, the belief that the impossible is actually possible. It isn't enough that people see and understand the stretch. They need to actually stretch themselves. The following are a few ways we discovered that multipliers produce this belief in their organizations. Helicopter down. One way multipliers generate belief is by taking the challenge down to the ground level. K.R. Sridhar, CEO of Bloom Energy, whose vision is to produce power generators for homes and businesses at half the carbon emissions of traditional power generators, explained, "The direction needs to be improbable, but not impossible. It can't just exist at 30,000 feet. It has to be at the 1,000-foot level. It is irresponsible to ask your team to do something if the CEO exposure is only at the 30,000-foot level. You have to take it down and show that it can be done. You have to show them a pathway and show why it can be done. You only need to do this once to create the belief. By helicoptering down to reality, multipliers create a meaningful proof point that a bold challenge can be successfully met. Lay out a path. Shai Agassi is a master at making the impossible seem possible. When he was leading the technology organization at SAP, he challenged the team to build a rapid deployment package that would allow a mid-sized company to install SAP in less than 7 days. This was unheard of, as a typical SAP implementation is measured in months, not days. But he didn't just issue this outrageous challenge, he helped find a path. He and the team analyzed historical implementations and found that 90% of the implementations shared the same features, and discovered that this configuration works for most mid-sized companies. With this insight, the team could see a path toward a 7-day implementation program, and they proceeded to make it happen. Co-create the plan. When people create the plan that they eventually will implement, belief in its viability will be inherently high. Led by Ray Lane in 1996, Oracle not only built a strategic intent, it also built a deep belief within the organization that Oracle could lead the Internet era. Because 250 senior leaders were given the opportunity to co-create the corporate strategy, they understood the challenge ahead and knew what actions would be necessary to achieve it. They had built the collective will and energy needed to execute. The organization was ready to take the challenge. Orchestrate an early win. Sometimes, the temptation exists for leaders to tackle too many problems all at once. Our research showed that multipliers begin with small, early wins and use those to generate belief toward the greater stretch challenges. Consider Nobel Prize winner Wangari Maathai. In her words, "I was hearing many Nairobi women complain that they didn't have enough firewood. They were also complaining that they did not have enough water. Why not plant trees?" I asked them. And so they just started very, very, very small. And before too long, they started showing each other. Communities began empowering each other to plant trees for their own needs. From just 7 original trees planted by Wangari on June 5, 1977, on World Environment Day, the Green Belt Movement has successfully planted more than 40 million trees in Africa. And, of course, the movement goes beyond trees. Wangari has written, "Many people don't understand that the tree is just an entry point. It is an easy point, because it is something that people understand. It is something people can do. It is not very expensive to do it, and you don't need too much technology to do it. But once we get into the community through tree planting, we deal with a lot of other issues. We deal with issues of governance, issues of human rights, issues of conflicts and peace, and issues of long-term resource management." Senior leaders and corporations can generate belief about significant challenges by orchestrating small, early wins. When the multiplier has generated belief in what is possible, the weight shifts, and the organization is willing to leave the realm of the known and venture into the unknown. The Academy Award-winning documentary Man on Wire chronicles the feat of renowned high-wire artist Philippe Petit in 1974, as he walked a tightrope stretched 140 feet across the expanse between the 1,368-foot-high twin towers of the World Trade Center in New York City. In the movie, Petit explains the moment of truth when he stood on the edge of one tower with his back foot on the building and his front foot on the cable. He recalled, "I had to make a decision of shifting my weight from one foot anchored to the building to the foot anchored on the wire. This is probably the end of my life to step on that wire. On the other hand, something I could not resist called me up on that cable." I have seen this shift of weight happen many times inside organizations. You can almost feel the energy of the organization begin to tip in a new direction. This shift happens when an individual or organization has fully embraced a challenge and has generated the belief in what is possible. It is not the multiplier who whips up this belief. Rather, it is the challenge he or she has issued that generates this commitment. This challenge process builds the intellectual muscle, the emotional energy, and the collective intent to move forward. Multipliers orchestrate the process needed to shift the weight of an organization. The diminishers' approach to setting direction. In contrast to multipliers, diminishers have a fundamentally different approach to providing direction. Instead of using their intelligence to enable people to stretch toward a future opportunity, they give directions in a way that showcases their superior knowledge. Instead of seeding an opportunity and laying out a believable challenge, diminishers tell and test. Like the stereotypical know-it-all, they tell people what they know, tell people how to do their jobs, and test other people's knowledge to see if they are doing it right. Tell what they know. Diminishers consider themselves thought leaders and readily share their knowledge. However, they rarely share it in a way that invites contribution. They tend to sell their ideas rather than learning what others know. One manager in Europe, quote, "took up all the oxygen in the room," unquote, by talking endlessly about his ideas. A peer said of him, "He is so busy sharing what he thinks, there is no space for anyone else." A direct report added this insight, "I have worked in the same department with him for 10 years, and he has never asked me a question. Not once. Not ever. I have occasionally heard him ask a question to the universe, 'I wonder why we do X.' But even then he fills the silence with his own thoughts about the answer." Test what you know. When diminishers do actually engage with others, to no surprise, it is as an auditor. They want to verify that you understand what they know. They ask questions to make a point rather than to access greater insight or to generate collective learning. Like Richard Palmer, the founder, discussed earlier, they are masters of the gotcha question. Diminishers leave people stressed but unstretched. Tell people how to do their jobs. Rather than shifting responsibility to other people, diminishers stay in charge and tell others, in detail, how to do their jobs. They assume the senior thinker posture, giving themselves permission to generate both the questions and the answers. One such diminisher was Chip Maxwell, an executive producer on a major motion picture production set. Despite the fact that the director had carefully assembled a world-class team of talent, Chip was constantly interfering in the team's work, routinely bypassing the director to tell his staff exactly how to do their jobs. The director of photography abruptly resigned in the middle of filming, claiming that if Chip seemed to know how to light the shot better than he did, then maybe he could be the DP. This award-winning DP knew the number of lights needed, and he certainly knew where to put them. He also knew his talents could be better used on another film. Diminishers often unintentionally shut down the intelligence of others. Most diminishers have built their careers on their own expertise and have been rewarded for their superior knowledge. For many, it is not until they reach a career plateau or crisis, or the director of photography quits in the middle of filming, that they begin to recognize that their base assumptions are inaccurate and are limiting themselves and others. A colleague of mine recently took an IQ test and received a score of 144. He was exuberant and claimed that he was just 1 point shy of certified genius status. No doubt he was envisioning his welcome letter from Mensa. On learning of our research, his enthusiasm became a bit dampened. Wow, I've worked all my life to prove I'm a genius, and just at the point that I can say that I am, I learn that it doesn't even matter anymore. Of course, this is only half right. Raw mental horsepower is still relevant, but the most powerful leaders are those who not only have this mental horsepower themselves, but also know how to multiply it by accessing and stretching other people's intelligence. Consider the difference between a leader who yearns for an additional IQ point to take their IQ to 145, official genius level, and leaders who use their intelligence to add an IQ point to every person in their organization. What could your organization accomplish if every person became effectively 1 point smarter? There are times when a leader is so knowledgeable and personally brilliant that it seems tempting for them to provide directives centered in what they know. However, in the end, know-it-alls limit what their organization can achieve to what they themselves know how to do. Under their leadership, the organization never leverages its full intelligence, and the true capacity of the organization is idled away or becomes consumed by the fire drill of figuring out what the boss thinks. How the challenger achieves resource leverage. Why do challengers get more from their resources? By playing the challenger instead of the know-it-all, they access more brains, get those brains working faster, and earn the full discretionary effort of their people. Once they have a clear view of the latent opportunities and challenges, they understand that there are no resources worthy of waste. Wisdom tells them that it is imperative to engage all intelligence and capability in service to these opportunities. The following information demonstrates why a know-it-all leaves so much intelligence on the table while challengers pull so much from their people. Know-it-alls, what they do. Give directives that showcase their knowledge. Know-it-alls, what they get. Distracted efforts as people vie for the attention of the boss. Idle cycles in the organization as people wait to be told what to do or to see if the boss will change direction again. An organization that doesn't want to get ahead of the boss. Challengers, what they do. Define opportunities that challenge people to go beyond what they know how to do. Challengers, what they get. Collective intent toward the same overarching opportunity. Rapid cycles and accelerated problem solving without the initiation of the formal leader. People's discretionary effort and intellectual energy to take on the toughest organizational challenges. When leaders operate as challengers, teams are able to accelerate their performance. Because the organization does not have to wait for the leader to think of it first, they can solve tougher problems at an accelerated rate. Because people understand the context, they can act for themselves rather than wait to be told or approved. Consider the contrast and impact that this diminisher and this multiplier had on the productivity and velocity of their organizations. A diminisher creates idle cycles. A highly intelligent vice president at a major global technology firm was accustomed to a fast-paced and demanding environment. He was a competitor in the market who never stopped challenging himself and others. However, after transferring to a division led by a classic know-it-all, he found himself idle most of the time. He said, "I spend most of my time waiting for my boss to make decisions. In the meantime, I can't do much else. I am essentially working part-time. I'm bored, but I am enjoying taking sailing lessons." This vice president was ready for high-speed battle, but was relegated to easy sailing. A multiplier creates rapid cycles. Barak Hershkovitz, previously referenced, left a comfortable job to work as the CTO for Better Place, where his new CEO laid down the challenge for him before he even started work. Barak said, "I did more in 1 year at Better Place than I did in 20 years at my previous company. I'm not a Gantt chart pusher. I can work extremely fast because I don't get punished for mistakes. We work fast forward." Because they are encouraged to be smarter than the leader, people can stop competing for idea validation and instead commit themselves to the challenge. And the result is that intelligence grows, individually and collectively. The collective intent built within the organization enables the whole group to break through challenges no single leader, however intelligent, could have. This understanding leads to a key question. How does someone provide direction like Shai Agassi at Better Place or Ray Lane at Oracle? How does someone go from a know-it-all to a challenger? Becoming a challenger. A serious case of curiosity. Becoming a challenger starts with developing an overactive imagination and a serious case of curiosity. In our research, we analyzed how multipliers and diminishers were rated against 48 leadership practices. It is not surprising that the highest-rated practice for multipliers was intellectual curiosity. Multipliers create genius in others because they are fundamentally curious and spark learning around them. This curiosity takes the form of an insatiable need for deep organizational understanding. The question, why, is at the core of their thinking. They ponder possibilities. They want to learn from people around them. At the heart of any challenge is intellectual curiosity. I wonder if we could do the impossible. How does one become more curious? 30 minutes watching, or in this case walking with a young child, will provide a good answer. I recall a particular walk with my daughter, who was 3 years old at the time. It was one of those walks designed to relax both parent and child, but it managed to do the opposite. As we walked through the neighborhood, my daughter looked at everything and wanted to know why. She asked, "Why is the dog barking?" and "Why is the road cracked?" and "Why do the cars go so fast?" This continued for some time. The questions got harder, and I was now running out of answers. I wondered how long this could go on. In an attempt to maintain my sanity and satisfy my own curiosity, I started counting the number of times my daughter asked why during our little walk. At the current rate, I thought she might just break 25. I stopped counting at 80. When deeply rooted in a mindset of curiosity, one is ready to begin working as a challenger. Here are several starting points. The starting block. 1. Go extreme with questions. Most executives are barraged with questions, constantly responding to others seeking their opinion. The nature of the executive role makes it easy to stay rooted in answer mode and to be the boss. The first step in this journey is to stop answering questions and begin asking them. Several years ago, I was commiserating with a colleague at work, Brian Spouts, about how I had become horribly bossy with my children and was frustrated. I detailed a typical evening at my house where I barked orders at my young children. "Get ready for bed. Stop that. Put on your pajamas. Brush your teeth. Pick up your toys." Brian was also a parent of young children and gave me some advice. He listened carefully and said, "Liz, I have a challenge for you. Tonight, when you go home, I want you to only speak to your children in the form of questions. No orders, no statements, just questions. I was naturally intrigued. He said, I think you might find that your children know exactly what they need to do. I agreed to take the challenge. He cautioned, only asking questions will feel awkward, but go all the way. Nothing but questions for at least an hour or two. That night, when it was time for bed, I asked my children, what time is it? They responded with, bedtime. I then asked, what do we do at bedtime? They responded with, we get on our pajamas and we brush our teeth. I continued the question routine with, well then, who is ready for bed? They scampered to get on their pajamas and brush their teeth. I stood in the hallway in shock. The rest of the evening proceeded in a similar fashion, with me asking them leading questions and them responding with remarkable understanding and eagerness to act. I reported this amazing experience to Brian the next day at work. He encouraged me to keep it up, not necessarily asking questions 100% of the time, but beginning to settle into a comfortable level. I did this and found that it transformed the way I operated as a parent, and it most certainly spilled over to how I managed at work. I have issued this same challenge to many leaders and have seen it transform their leadership as they shifted their balance and began asking more and telling less. It has helped them draw out the intelligence of people around them and guide others through a challenge. Take the extreme question challenge to shift from know-it-all into challenger mode. Start with 100%. Try it at home. You might find that your children, or housemates, are good guinea pigs and great teachers. At work, take the first step by finding a meeting that you can lead solely with questions. You might be surprised at what people around you already know. 2. Take a bus trip. University of Michigan professor Noel Teachey tells a story about an executive at GE who found a creative way to seed a challenge and help his organization see a need in the marketplace. When Tom Tiller took over the failing appliance division at GE, the division was losing money, slashing its workforce, and hadn't released a new product in years. Tom loaded 40 people from his management team onto a rented bus and headed for the Atlanta Kitchen and Bath Show. The group was to find trends and needs and generate new product ideas that would keep the plant alive. The group developed a new line of products and turned around the division from a staggering loss to a $10 million profit. There are many ways to take a bus trip. Irene Fisher of the Benyon Center took people into the inner city so they could see the needs of the poor firsthand. As a corporate manager, you might visit a customer's factory floor to watch how a customer actually uses your product. You can take your team down to the local mall to watch people shop, but go together on a bus trip. Help people see the need that must get met. Make it a learning experience that will reveal that need, create energy, and ignite a fire within your organization. 3. Take a massive baby step. The corporate world has a plethora of names for this. Create an early win, deliver a symbolic victory, and the favorite, pick the low-hanging fruit. But the problem is that most leaders do this in isolation. They pick a small group to run a pilot, which catches the attention of the management, but don't have the visibility to get the attention of the entire organization. Instead, do it en masse. Make it visible. Create a conference room pilot for a new technology and hold an open house. Win back an important customer through the efforts of a cross-functional task force. Get the entire organization to take a small first step. But do it together, en masse, so everyone can see the results and start to believe that something great is possible. This belief is what will shift the weight of the organization out onto that high wire. A good stretch. Jimmy Carter said, "If you have a task to perform and are vitally interested in it, excited and challenged by it, then you will exert maximum energy. But in the excitement, the pain of fatigue dissipates, and the exuberance of what you hope to achieve overcomes the weariness." Our research showed that multipliers make challenges both provocative and plausible, attracting others to join them and offer their full capability, both intellectually and emotionally. Their approach generates the collective will and stretch needed to undertake the most paramount of challenges. What is this like for the people who are willing to sign up? It is, quote, exhilarating, exhausting, challenging, gratifying, unquote. This means that multipliers get contributions from their people that far surpass what they thought they had to give, and it is this concomitant exhilaration that makes people sign up again and again. Chapter 4 Summary. The Multiplier Formula. The Know-It-All versus the Challenger. Know-It-Alls give directives that showcase how much they know. As a result, they limit what their organization can achieve to what they themselves know how to do. The organization uses its energy to deduce what the boss thinks. Challengers define opportunities that challenge people to go beyond what they know how to do. As a result, they get an organization that understands the challenge and has the focus and energy to take it on. The three practices of the challenger. 1. Seed the opportunity. Show the need. Challenge the assumptions. Reframe problems. Create a starting point. 2. Lay down a challenge. Extend a concrete challenge. Ask the hard questions. Let others fill in the blanks. 3. Generate belief in what is possible. Helicopter down. Lay out a path. Co-create the plan. Orchestrate an early win. Becoming a challenger. 1. Ask a leading question. 2. Take a bus trip. 3. Take a massive baby step. Unexpected findings. 1. Even when leaders have a clear view of the future, there are advantages to simply seeding the opportunities. 2. Challengers have full range of motion. They can see and articulate the big thinking and ask the big questions, but they can also connect that to the specific steps needed to create movement. 3. If you ask people to take on the impossible in the right way, it can actually create more safety than if you ask for something easier.
Chapter 5. The Debate Maker. It is better to debate a decision without settling it than settling a decision without debating it. Joseph Joubert.
How leaders make decisions is profoundly influenced by how they engage and leverage the resources around them. Our research has shown that diminishers tend to make decisions solo or with a small inner circle. As a result, they not only underutilize the intelligence around them, but they also leave the organization spinning instead of executing. Multipliers make decisions by first engaging people in debate, not only to achieve sound decisions, but also to develop collective intelligence and to ready their organizations to execute. Jonathan Akers illustrated the difference between these two approaches when he drove a high-stakes decision at a multinational software company. Jonathan Akers had recently landed a global role as vice president in corporate planning and was eager to make an impact on the business. The company was entangled in a competitive contest over ownership of the mid-market space. Their largest competitor dominated the small business market, while they owned the enterprise data space. In search of market control and revenue growth, this company began moving down market while their competitor was moving up. Winning the mid-market was symbolically important, but it would take an entirely new business model to get there. Jonathan had been asked to lead the development of a new pricing model to enable them to penetrate the market. It was just the opportunity he needed to deliver a tangible success. Eager to get it right on an issue of such strategic import, Jonathan assembled a team with all the right players, including a broad coalition of leaders from product, marketing, services, and business practices, many of whom had a deep understanding of the mid-market space. The group came together in a large conference room on the top floor of their sleek headquarters in Silicon Valley. Jonathan sat at the head of a narrow table. He began the conversation by laying out the challenge to the group, teeing up the issues, and turning on the heat for the work of the task force. He made it clear that the CEO and other top lieutenants of the company were expecting significant progress in the mid-market. Driven by a high-stakes mandate, people began compiling data and analysis and submitting it to Jonathan over the course of several weeks. The task force had just been set in motion, but already it was beginning to spin with confusion. Jonathan had left unclear the role the task force members would play and how the recommendations and decisions would actually get made. Instead of using the brain power inherent in the task force, Jonathan used the task force as an audience for his own ideas. He consumed most of the time of the task force meetings over-articulating his own biases or dropping names. Although he gathered data from each task force member quite tenaciously, none of this information was shared or discussed in the task force meetings. There was plenty of data gathered, but there was simply no debate. The meetings atrophied into opinion-based conversation, mostly Jonathan's. One task force member shared his frustration. "I came to these meetings hoping to hear from this brain trust we assembled, but all I heard was Jonathan's point of view." Although people were led to believe they would be a critical part of the decision, they quickly realized that the task force wasn't where the decision would be made, or even recommended, nor was it a forum for debate where their individual or collective thinking would be challenged. It appeared that the decision would be made by a select few behind closed doors. The suspicions turned out to be true. Nothing much came of their work, but they did eventually receive a sudden email from Jonathan with the subject line, "Announcement of new pricing model," and knew the decision had been made without them. Instead of generating collective understanding and optimism about the mid-market, Jonathan generated disillusionment about the company's prospects for winning in this market, and he personally earned a reputation as a time waster. The immediate impact was apparent the next time Jonathan called a task force meeting. Every other chair around the huge conference room table was empty. But the more far-reaching result was that the company continued to stall in the mid-market while their competitors gained traction and market share. This is a story played out far beyond this top-floor conference room. It is repeated because, while many leaders like Jonathan attempt the management practice of inclusion and discussion, they are still operating with an elitist view of intelligence, believing the brain power for the organization sits with a select few. They lack a rich view of intelligence, in which there are many sources of insight waiting to be more fully utilized, and where intelligence actually develops through engagement and challenge. A leader's ability to garner the full intelligence of the organization depends on some of his or her most deeply held assumptions. The decision-maker versus the debate-maker. Mind of the multiplier. Diminishers like Jonathan Aker seem to hold an assumption that there are only a few people worth listening to. Sometimes they state that thought out loud, like the executive who admitted to listening to only one or two people from his 4,000-person organization. But typically such executives manifest their assumption in more subtle ways. They ask their direct reports to interview candidates for an open position, but they end up hiring the person their star employee favors. They say they have an open-door policy, but seem to spend a lot of time in closed-door meetings with one or two highly influential advisors. They might patronize people by asking for their opinion, but when it comes down to the high-stakes decisions, they make them privately and announce them to the organization. Multipliers hold a very different view. They don't focus on what they know, but on how to know what others know. They seem to assume that with enough minds, we can figure it out. They are interested in every relevant insight people can offer, like the executive who, even late at night, after a 12-hour debate, insisted the team listen to one more comment from a junior member of the group. The comment turned out to be the crucial insight necessary for solving the question at hand. It's no surprise that multipliers approach decisions by bringing people together, discovering what they know, and encouraging people to challenge and stretch each other's thinking through collective dialogue and debate. These core assumptions lie at the heart of the differences in how diminishers and multipliers make decisions. By assuming there are only a few people worth listening to, diminishers operate as decision makers. When the stakes are at their highest, they rely on their own knowledge or an inner circle of people to make the decision. When multipliers are faced with a high-stakes decision, they have a different gravity pull toward the full brain power of their organization. In harnessing this knowledge, they play the role of the debate maker. They realize that not all decisions need collective input and debate, but on decisions of consequence, they lead rigorous debate that prosecutes the issues with hard facts and depersonalizes decisions. Through debate, they challenge and stretch what people know, thus making the organization smarter over time and creating the organizational will to execute the decisions made. The decider versus a team of rivals. Examining the core decision-making approach of President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama reveals key differences in their stated approach to making high-stakes decisions. Mr. Bush has characterized himself as the decider, and Time magazine described him as leading the Blink presidency, after Malcolm Gladwell's book Blink about the phenomenon of making instantaneous decisions. In an interview with Washington Post writer Bob Woodward, Mr. Bush said, "I'm a gut player. I play by instincts. I don't play by the book." After writing a 4-book series on the president, which included 11 hours of personal interviews with Mr. Bush, Woodward concluded, "I think Bush is impatient. I think, my summation, he doesn't like homework. And homework means reading or getting briefed or having a debate. And part of the presidency, part of governing, particularly in this area, is homework, homework, homework." We saw the consequences of rapid, centralized decision-making, which led the United States into war with Iraq in 2003. Regarding the 2007 surge in Iraq, Mr. Bush asked tougher questions of his security team than he had with the original invasion because, quote, "different times call for different kinds of questions," unquote. But, as a matter of record, he kept himself away from some of the meetings where key decisions about the surge were made, telling Woodward, "I'm not in these meetings, you'll be happy to hear, because I got other things to do." In contrast, Mr. Obama has stated an intent to follow Abraham Lincoln's approach to decision-making, an approach that can be summarized by the title of a book by Doris Kearns Goodwin on Lincoln called A Team of Rivals. After introducing members of his national security team at a press conference in December 2008, which included his fierce rival in the election primaries, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, Mr. Obama was asked how he would ensure the group worked as a team of rivals rather than a clash of rivals. He responded with clarity, "I assembled this team because I am a strong believer in strong personalities and strong opinions. I think this is how the best decisions are made. One of the dangers in a White House, based on my reading of history, is that you get wrapped up in groupthink and everybody agrees with everything and there is no discussion and no dissenting views. So, I am going to be welcoming a vigorous debate inside the White House. Understand that I will be setting policy as president. I will be responsible for the vision that this team carries out, and I expect them to implement that vision once decisions are made." According to a New York Times article on March 28, 2009, Mr. Obama's stated approach to foreign policy decisions has been carried out in practice. The article outlines the debate that took place in the White House over the plan to widen the efforts being made in the Afghanistan war. "The debate over the past few weeks," wrote Helene Cooper, "offered a glimpse into how Mr. Obama makes decisions. In the end, a compromise was reached that reflected all the strains of the discussion among his advisors." David Brooks wrote about Obama's approach to foreign policy decision-making this way. "The election revolved around passionate rallies. The Obama White House revolves around a culture of debate. He leads long, analytic discussions, which bring competing arguments to the fore. He sometimes seems to preside over the arguments like a judge settling a lawsuit. His policies are often a balance as he tries to accommodate different points of view. He doesn't generally issue edicts. This style has never been more evident than in his decision to expand the war in Afghanistan." These two approaches capture the essence of the difference between decision makers and debate makers. History will show the long-term impact of these two approaches, but even in matters of high politics, the approach a leader takes in making a decision matters. The debate maker. Lutz Ziop, the executive at Microsoft highlighted earlier, approaches decision-making in his organization with both the mind and the practices of a debate maker. When Lutz took over the education business at Microsoft in 2003, it was a traditional education business that delivered five-day instructor-led classes through corporate training partners, but it was falling short of its goals for revenue and reach. Lutz faced a double whammy. The organization urgently needed to return to positive and profitable revenue growth, and at the same time, it needed to greatly extend its reach to ensure as many customers and potential customers as possible had a command of Microsoft's technology. As general manager of the Microsoft Learning business, Lutz needed to decide if they should look for this revenue and reach within the current base of corporate training partners, or if they should pursue a bold and potentially risky new approach in the academic sector. Lutz, who speaks with a softened German accent, has that rare combination of passion and reserve. He is a veteran of the technology education business with a masterful command of both the strategy and the details of running his business. His team is diverse precisely because he has recruited them to be. Several are longtime Microsoft staffers. Others have deep experience with education at other global technology firms. Several are new to their current role because they are in stretch assignments outside their usual domain and functional expertise. After 15 minutes with Lutz, you can tell he is quite capable of making these decisions himself, given his vast knowledge. And given the stakes, many executives would have felt the pull to do so. But Lutz has a bias for debate and a conviction that the more vital the decision, the more rigorous and inclusive the decision-making process should be. So he set out to engage his leadership team with the challenge at hand. He gathered his team and teed up the issue with a big question. Should they refocus their entire business on the academic market, distributing education through the schools instead of through corporate training providers? Should they risk their current business model to potentially achieve significantly higher reach? He gave the team their assignments. They would meet in a couple of weeks on Rocos Island near Microsoft's HQ in Redmond, Washington. They were to bring all the information they could gather and come with views about the academic market space. Gathered on Rocos Island, the team had the usual off-site environment, a great physical location, pens and flip charts, a big, open, light conference room, but more important, they had been given permission to think. Because everyone was prepared, Lutz could quickly frame the issue and launch right into the challenge. As you know, the entire $300 million education business we are in has been based on a potentially outdated model. The decision we face is whether to cling to this business model or introduce a totally new model that would push the education out of the corporate classroom space and into academics where we would reach students much earlier in their careers. He set broad parameters for the debates. He insisted, "I expect your best thinking here. Everyone should feel not only welcome to speak up, but an obligation to speak up. You can expect us to be thorough. We will be prosecuting assumptions and asking ourselves the tough questions." Then he officially launched the first of several debates. He sparked the debate through a series of bold questions. Should we be in the academic space? And what would success require? After each question, he let the team jump in and he let the debate proceed. As the discussion was beginning to reach a settling point, he pushed harder, asking people to switch sides and argue against their previously stated position. He chimed in, "Chris, switch sides with Raza. Raza, you've been for this idea. You now argue against it. Chris, you now argue for it." They would switch roles, which felt awkward for a moment or two, but soon they'd begin to pound the issues from the other vantage point. Or, to broaden people's perspectives, he asked his people to assume roles outside of their functional area. Lutz persisted. "Teresa, you've been offering an international perspective on this. Now look at it with a domestic hat on." And, "Leanne, you've been looking at the technical issues. I want you to debate this from the marketing perspective." The team stepped away from their positions and a new set of sparks erupted. Lutz loved to stir up controversy and would become noticeably disappointed if the debate wasn't charged and the sparks weren't flying. The team listened passionately to the rich and different perspectives. They challenged one another's assumptions and often their own. They happily dropped the polite professionalism that typifies so many corporate meetings and took on the challenges with an almost ferocious appetite. This was a high-stakes approach to a high-stakes decision. In the end, the organization decided that they would pursue the academic market, and they spent the next 2 years repivoting the business around students and academia. The business expanded their reach from 1,500 corporate training partners to 4,700 academic partners, three times the scale in just 2 years. It is currently set to become the biggest reach driver of their now profitable business. Lutz did not leave debate to chance. He knew that while creating a debate is easy, creating a rigorous debate requires a deliberate approach. The three practices of the debate maker. In our research, we found that multipliers did three specific things very differently from diminishers when it came to decision making. While diminishers raise issues, dominate discussions, and force decisions, multipliers, 1. Frame the issues, 2. Spark the debate, and 3. Drive sound decisions. Let us examine each of these in more detail. 1. Frame the issue. Our research showed that debate makers know that the secret sauce of a great debate is what they do before the debate actually begins. They prepare the organization for the debate by forming the right questions and the right team and framing the issues and process in a way in which everyone can contribute. The process is broken down below. Define the question. Tim Brown, the chief executive and president of IDEO, the famously innovative global design consultancy firm, said, "As leaders, probably the most important role we can play is asking the right questions and focusing on the right problems. It's very easy in business to get sucked into being reactive to the problems and questions that are right in front of you. It doesn't matter how creative you are as a leader, it doesn't matter how good the answers you come up with. If you're focusing on the wrong questions, you're not really providing the leadership you should." Multipliers use their own know-how to shape the way people look at issues. They have the ability to frame the questions in a way that nobody else would have thought about. They sift through a variety of factors to identify the right issues and spend time formulating the right questions. These questions unearth and challenge the assumptions that entrench the organization in old patterns and thinking, surface the fundamental tensions and trade-offs to be considered in a decision, force people to examine the facts and confront reality, ensure multiple perspectives on an issue. As Tim Brown said, "The right questions aren't just kind of lying around on the ground to be picked up and asked. The work of the multiplier is to find the right issue and formulate the right question so others can find the answers." Form the team. Multipliers ensure a great debate by having the right people in the debate. Potential candidates for a great debate include those with knowledge or insight needed to inform the issue, key stakeholders for the decision, those with responsibility for driving the outcome of the decision. Assemble the data. Multipliers identify the decision-critical data that needs to be gathered and analyzed prior to the debate. They ask others to come to the debate armed with relevant information so they are prepared to contribute. When Tim Cook, the COO of Apple Incorporated, assembles a team to debate an important business decision, the team knows they are expected to gather and thoroughly analyze the data in advance. Tim's team understands that when they offer their opinions, those opinions need to be informed by fact, not anecdote. One member of Tim's management team is known for bringing in a box of extra backup data with him to these debates, just in case. Frame the decision. In preparation for the meeting itself, debate makers define what needs to be addressed, why it is important, and how the final decision is expected to be made. The what. Multipliers explicitly state what question needs to be addressed. The why. They shed light on what is happening in the environment that is prompting the need for the debate, and they lay out the stakes involved. the how. Multipliers take time up front to clarify the decision-making process and establish roles, including their own. They answer questions such as, how long will we have to make the decision? Who will recommend? Who will decide? As a result of properly framing the issues, every person knows what is at stake, what is expected of them, and the level of honesty and rigor that will be required of the group as a whole. In illustrating how debate makers frame the issues, let's return to Lutz at Microsoft. Recently, Lutz needed to make a tough budget cut decision, so he pulled his lieutenants together for a debate. According to a member of his management team, he teed up the issue and set the context for the meeting. We are here to answer a tough question. What is the best way to take 20% out of our budget? He went on to explain the need for action. He was fully transparent. He didn't hoard information. He just shared openly that HQ had requested a certain amount of budget back and why. Then he outlined the process. Each person needed to explain where the money should be taken out of the organization and why. Once it was debated fully, he would make the final decision. They debated for more than 2 hours, during which time he played the role of facilitator, ensuring that each member of his team debated the issues rigorously. When a decision is high stakes, debate makers require everyone's best thinking. They know people will do their best thinking if the issues are framed well and defined and the questions of the debate are clear. They know that the debate will be richest if it is based in facts, not opinions, and that it takes foresight to gather the right information. Because they take time to prepare and frame the issue, multipliers are able to leverage more capability from their people than their diminisher counterparts. Multipliers ensure people don't waste their brain power and enthusiasm spinning on tangential issues. By framing the debate in terms of key questions within a clear context, they are able to foster motivation and readiness and help elicit 100% from their people. Multipliers love debate, but they debate with a purpose. They know what they want out of the debate and what they want out of the people involved. Multipliers aren't just debaters. They are debate makers. 2. Spark the debate. After framing of the issue, multipliers spark the debate. Through our research and coaching work with executives, I have observed 4 elements of a great debate. A great debate is engaging. The question is compelling and important to everyone in attendance. Comprehensive. The right information is shared to generate a holistic and collective understanding of the issues at hand. Fact-based. The debate is deeply rooted in fact, not opinion. Educational. People leave the debate more focused on what they learned than on who won or lost. How do you lead this type of debate? There are 2 key elements that couple and form the yin and the yang of great debate. The first is to create safety. The second is to demand rigor. Multipliers do both. The yin. Create safety for best thinking. How do multipliers create a safe climate for people's best thinking? They do it by removing fear. They remove the factors that cause people to doubt themselves or their ideas and the fear that causes people to hold back. One senior manager we interviewed told us about his current boss. Amit has strong opinions, but he lets the discussion happen before he expresses that opinion. And further, you know where you stand with Amit. He maintains a balance of respect, but is also brutally honest if something doesn't make sense. I've never gotten into trouble telling my manager what I think. Another executive we've worked with knew that she had a reputation for being smart and strong-willed, and that she could be intimidating. A direct report has noticed a recent change in her. When the group is debating an issue, Jennifer makes it a point to hold her views until the end. She gives a chance for each member of her executive team to express